from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, January the 23rd, 2020. We have a good show lined up for you today. We've got a couple of new guests, folks who have not been on the Dave Graham Show before. We're coming in this morning. I'm really excited to introduce them to our lineup here. Kevin McCollum is a reasonably new reporter to up at 7 Days. He's covering the State House for them, and he's had several excellent stories already. We want to bring him in to talk about a really interesting one that appeared in the paper and on their website just in the last day or so. We'll be talking with Kevin in just a couple of minutes after I tell you what else is coming up. Linda Fowler from Dartmouth College is going to be my guest in the second half hour. She's a political scientist there and a frequent commentator, especially in New Hampshire media, relating to the presidential primary over there, presidential politics in general. Linda also is a someone who can who's an expert on Congress and can help us understand what's happening with the impeachment hearings down in Washington. The second hour of the program, Thursdays, we devote to our Seeds to Society segment. This is put together with the help of the College of Arts, College of Agriculture, CALS, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont. And they come up with a lot of very interesting topics to bring on to the show here relating to food and farming and the way we all eat and grow our products and so on. Today we have Meredith Niles and Josh Kelly. They're actually going to be talking about something that's maybe a little bit unusual for that segment, but I guess it's related, though, because it has to do with compost, especially Vermont's longstanding law. Now, it's been on the books for years, but it's finally the final stages are taking effect this year. As of July 1st, we really have to get serious about food waste in this state. There are going to be some new regulations kicking into effect, and we're going to have a conversation with Josh Kelly of the Agency of Natural Resources and Meredith Niles of UVM in the second hour to talk about what happens there and why and how important it is. So that'll be an interesting conversation as well. But let's get right into it with Kevin McCollum from 7 Days this morning. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here.
And Kevin, you had, as I mentioned, a really interesting story yesterday. I was a longtime reporter for the AP over at the State House, and I remember the creation of the House Ethics Panel, a fair amount of resistance among some lawmakers to even the idea of setting it up. We're so pure here in Vermont. How could we possibly need an ethics panel? And the entity that ended up getting set up is probably not the toughest sheriff I've ever seen ride into town. So tell us about the story you had yesterday involving a legislator from Bennington.
Well, I, as you said, I'm fairly new to the State House. This is my second session covering the State House, and I didn't even realize that there was an ethics panel. It's a 5-member group of legislators who meet almost entirely in secret to discuss complaints that have been filed against members. And so when Chris Bates and I were talking about some issues and he mentioned that he had been the subject of an ethics complaint, I was taken aback because I didn't know that there was such a mechanism, and I did not expect a representative to acknowledge that they had been brought up on ethics charges.
So I'm sure any good reporter's ears would perk up at that point, and you were like,
absolutely.
Really? Let me get out my notebook.
Yeah, let's talk.
And he was willing to talk, which was kind of a surprising thing.
It did surprise me, yeah, because obviously you wouldn't think someone would share that information, but he had a very specific reason for wanting to talk about it, and that was that he felt he'd been treated very poorly, and he was on the receiving end of about a $10,000 legal bill to defend himself in that case. So he felt that that was just a flawed and inappropriate way for legislators to have to address criticisms that are brought against them. And the other reason that he thought that it was unfair was because of where it came from. It came from some of his political enemies, essentially, in Bennington, and mm-hmm. he felt that they were on a smear campaign, basically, to make his life as difficult as possible. And to be honest, I think they succeeded.
and you reported that the sort of leader of this charge down in Bennington was a wife of the person who ran against him in the last election, correct?
I don't know if wife is the right phrase, but I think girlfriend maybe is the closest, or partner, I think is probably the right phrase. Yeah. Right. So she, her name is Colleen Harrington, and she did file the complaint against Chris, and she basically said that he was a fugitive felon on the run back when he was elected to the House of Representatives, and that is actually the felon part is accurate. And on the run is debatable, but he did have an outstanding warrant for his arrest from the state of Illinois at the time that he was elected to the House of Representatives in Vermont. And he says it was an oversight. He says it was something that he just failed to resolve before he left Illinois and moved to Vermont. But he wasn't in no way on the run. But nevertheless, if you do have an outstanding warrant for your arrest on a felony, some people would certainly characterize that as being on the run.
Particularly your political opponents, it sounds
exactly.
Sounds like the kind of thing,
a
bit of phrasing that gets applied by political opponents.
Absolutely.
In a case like this. What was the underlying crime that was alleged out in Illinois?
Yeah, it was his third arrest for DUI, and so that is a felony in that state.
Yeah, and that's a serious thing. I mean, I think a lot of us have made it to, he's 60 years old, and I'm 63, and never had a, I guess knock on wood, but I've never had a DUI. My first DUI.
Yeah.
And three DUIs in one over the course of one driving lifetime is too many, too many.
So, and Chris would say, look, this is 9 years ago now. This is something that happened in 2010. The case was resolved essentially or could have been resolved with a felony conviction in 2012. So this is old. He tried to make the case as this is old news, and I think he tried to make that case to the panel as well. He tried to say, look, the ethics panel is set up to address complaints that are made against representatives during the biennium. You know, you should not be able to go years and years and years back into someone's history and file an ethics complaint to say, hey, they did something unethical back when they were young. That he feels that's just an inappropriate use of the system. And I think Harrington and others would say, well, that may be true that the underlying criminal charge is old, but the outstanding warrant was very active, and that is an unethical and a problematic thing.
And I guess the other sort of aspect of that complaint from Ms. Harrington would be, did he have any obligation to make it public that he had this background? And my guess would be probably not. Does he, or what do you think?
Well, we got to be very careful here, right? Because obligation under ethics rules, obligations under basic codes of forthrightness and honesty. I think he would say that he did not realize he had the outstanding warrant. He, in his mind, the case was closed, and that running for a House seat in Vermont in 2018, he did not have any obligation to tell people that he had a DUI arrest in 6 years earlier.
Is there any indication here that he still occasionally drives under the influence?
I have no indication that he's driving at all. I don't know if he has a license, and I don't know if he has been had anything other than a clean record since 2012.
Okay. And one other aspect of this thing, he allegedly misstated his criminal background during a radio call-in show.
Yeah.
What's that all about?
So it's gets into the weeds a little bit, but the complaint process before the ethics panel was a lengthy one, and it began in June when Ms. Harrington made her complaint against him. But then it continued for months and months and months, and that was one of Chris's complaints, was that this thing just goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And during the over the summer and into the fall, he had apparently gone on a radio call-in show down in Bennington, a local radio call-in show, and he was chatting with the host, and they were taking calls from constituents, from residents. And one of those calls came in from someone who was saying, hey, aren't you a felon on the run? And what's with your criminal background? And, tell us all about your long rap sheet. I hear it's 18 pages long. And he responded in a way that I think some people took as sort of dismissive of of those questions and evasive of those direct questions that were being asked. Now, I'm sure that caller was maybe aligned with or otherwise maybe one of his political enemies in Bennington.
Yep.
But the way he answered those questions, I think, got him in more trouble because the show was recorded and I'm not sure who forwarded that, the transcript of that show to the panel, but then the panel saw that he was on the radio discussing his criminal record in a way that was, I think, as the chairman put it, misleading.
Okay, I just want this lesson to be really highlighted and maybe carved in stone here, folks. Never, ever fib to a radio host, okay?
That's a bad idea.
That's a bad idea.
It's going to come back to bite you.
Yeah. So, and this guy is... where does this thing now stand now? It's finally been dismissed, has it?
Yeah, he actually, that was actually one of the odd things, is that the ethics panel apparently waited to dismiss its the complaint, to close the complaint against him, till after he mopped up and resolved his criminal charge. They weren't going to essentially let him off the hook until he took care of what he needed to take care of.
Okay.
So he went back, he had someone go back to Illinois and talk to the court there about the outstanding warrant, and then he had somebody go and talk to the judge on his behalf, I think, in Illinois to do what he needed to do to get the underlying charge resolved. I think it involved some counseling and paying some fines, and then once all that occurred, that charge finally was dropped in December, and then very quickly after the charge was dropped, the panel said, okay, fine. We're going to drop the ethics charge too, but we want to warn you that we're not too happy with the way this whole thing has gone.
Yeah, I guess, in a way that makes sense, that basically the ethics panel, having received this complaint, you could argue whether it's a fair complaint and since it involved stuff from long ago and et cetera, but the ethics panel, having received the complaint, tells the guy, hey, you gotta resolve this. You gotta pay your fine, or you gotta get this cleared up in your old home state, and then we'll drop it here. And so, I mean, in some ways, that picture at least has some, some completion to it, and it feels like that their role here is reasonable. I want to take a. We have a listener on the line. I want to get some thoughts from Don from Elmore, but after that, I want to ask you. He still seems to have some complaints with the ethics process here, so we'll talk a little more about those. Let's go to Don from Elmore. Good morning, Don.
Morning, Dave. Let's take a little bit harder line on this whole business.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel comfortable with people who have got DWI convictions serving in the legislature?
I actually do. I regard the legislature as a representative body. And if I think that one or two or three out of 180 people in Vermont have DUI convictions, I'm not going to be shocked by that. So I actually think that it's part of the world, and the legislature is supposed to be representative of our society, right?
Well, I understand what you're saying there, but by the same token, we're supposed to be picking the best of the best to serve in the legislature. And when I see the number of DUI convictions in the paper every week, and you talk to some of the troopers around, and the number of people that are out there driving drunk in this state now, I think we ought to be a lot more concerned about it than we are. Yeah, maybe one conviction, fine. But I'm to the point where I think anybody with a second conviction for DWI ought to be barred from the legislature.
That's an interesting thought. I don't know if there is a law in Vermont saying that anybody with any kind of a criminal or civil enforcement background like that.
That's my whole point, Dave. My whole point.
Yeah.
To me, we should be holding these people to a higher standard.
Okay.
And sometimes I wonder if we're really doing that at all, and if we're getting the best out of the legislature that we should be getting.
Let me ask my guest, Kevin McCollum from 7 Days. Do you have any thoughts on
that?
All I know is that during the course of the ethics complaint process, Chris Bates's attorney pointed out very pointedly to the panel that there is no prohibition in the state of Vermont for people to serve in the legislature with criminal records. And so that was one of the reasons that he felt the whole thing was just an inappropriate process, because there's no problem with someone serving in the legislature if they have a criminal background, and I think there's a presumption that if you have a criminal record when you run for office, that it is a public, that's public information, and that the voters knew about that and know about that when they elect you, and so that's their decision.
Don, thanks for the call. It's an interesting point. I haven't really, I don't think, thought it through in any detail, but the, I don't know, I still sort of have an idea of redemption. You know, somebody could be a heavy drinker for in their 20s and 30s, get three, rack up three DUIs, and then go to AA and never drink again, or go to some other 12-step or whatever program to get over their alcohol addiction, never drink again, and then what? 7 days has what, three people at the State House now, right?
That's right.
And you guys are geared up and ready to kick butt and take names, and it's great.
I think we're doing a great job. We got a great team up there.
I'm really happy to see some good, solid State House coverage. You know, a few years ago, the Vermont Press Bureau used to be run by the Rutland Herald and Times Argus. That closed. They're still doing some State House coverage, but not as daily and not as in-depth as they used to, certainly. The Burlington Free Press has scaled way back. You know, AP cut its staff down to two people now. It's so it's great to see others, including 7 Days, VT Digger. VPR has beefed up, so I'm just so glad to see there's still some journalism happening in Montpelier. Anyway, Kevin McCollum is one of the new crew. He came in. You said it's your second session in Montpelier,
right? That's right.
And did you do any? You were from California. Did you do any State House coverage out there?
I covered the City Council of the largest city on the North Coast of California, mm-hmm. And I was there for about 14 years at a great little paper called the Press Democrat
in Santa Rosa, right?
Santa Rosa, California. Yeah.
Yep.
I really enjoyed living there and working at that paper. We won the Pulitzer Prize in 2018 for some of our coverage of some of the devastating wildfires that raced through Santa Rosa back in 2017. And so that was a great run.
Yeah, and I welcome to Vermont. It sounds
Thanks.
Like we're lucky to have a serious journalist added to the crew here. And every state capital needs every state needs good journalism and hardworking reporters. And I think Vermont is actually lucky in that regard, because I know if you go to a lot of other state capitals around the country, you know, people talk about the Vermont press corps being thin. It's a lot thinner elsewhere.
Yeah, no, all over the country, news organizations have pulled back, and one of the key places that they've often pulled back on is the State House coverage. I think some editors made the decision that sort of the nuts and bolts kind of coverage of legislation is a little dry, and that if they're going to pull back in parts of their organizations, that's where they were going to do it. But I think that's a huge mistake.
And yet, I, if it's done right, I think State House coverage can actually be wonderful and really. You can delve into a lot of different aspects of humanity just in terms of what comes through a legislature, both in terms of kind of the characters who come to play and also the issues that come in and out of the building. It's a very, very important beat. I think in most states, it's probably the most important beat. I did it for a long time for the AP, basically, essentially because I felt that way. So maybe that's my bias toward it. But
I fully agree. It's a fascinating place to be a reporter. And if you view it just as sort of reporting on what bills are being proposed and what policy changes people would like to see in the state and why and what impact that might have on the state, that's plenty right there. But then layered on top of that, you have the personalities and the dramas that happen every day up there. It's just it's a fascinating place to work.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, we have had State House coverage over the years. I remember very early in my career talking to a legislator who liked to talk about the fact that he thought it was a six-pack from Ludlow to Rutland, mm-hmm. driving from Ludlow to Rutland. I don't remember exactly the mileage there, but that's a lot of beer for that trip, and you would be DUI by the time you got to Rutland if that's the trip you're on.
Yep.
Anyway, speaking of DUI, we've been focusing on this guy.
And speaking of characters.
How's that for a segue?
Yeah.
We've been back to Chris Bates, this representative from Bennington, who had his third DUI conviction in Illinois, moves to Vermont, runs for the State House, and in the process of doing so, apparently doesn't really mention much about his background in Illinois, and ends up in front of the House Ethics Panel. Now, I want to zero in on the Ethics Panel for a minute, because we have a State Ethics Commission, and it's sort of a repeat performance, if you ask me, in some ways, because there's always this push-pull at the State House about how, you know, we don't need Well, a lot of people say we don't need an ethics panel because we're so pure here in Vermont. Number two, it's going to create a new bureaucracy. You know, the Ethics Commission, for instance, has a part-time executive director, and do we really need to be spending this money? And, you know, frankly, a lot of legislators don't like to lie awake at night and wonder, am I going to be hauled in front of the ethics panel or the ethics commission or whatever the case is? And what do you think, Kevin? Is this a process of ducking by the fact that we don't have a very toothy ethics process in Vermont?
Well, you know, it's a little difficult for me to say. I've been here, this is the only case I've ever learned of or witnessed going through the ethics process. Obviously, it ended with what can I think best be described as a slap on the wrist. I mean, they did not bring formal ethics charges against Chris Bates. They didn't censure him. They didn't remove him from office. None of those things occurred. And you can argue that, well, that his conduct, you know, didn't merit that. And so everything worked properly. And they kept it secret. You know, that there was no one on the ethics panel who was saying, psst, hey, did you hear that there's an ethics complaint against Chris Bates? He outed himself. He said, hey, look, I am the subject of an ethics complaint.
And if he hadn't done that, it never would have come out.
This story wouldn't have come out if he hadn't said that. I mean, there was a story that I saw somewhere maybe a month ago about the ethics panel putting out a report saying that there had been a complaint filed against a member of the House last year. Mm-hmm. And I remember that we talked about that at 7 Days. We said,
Who's that?
Yeah. I wonder who that might be. And we didn't make any headway on finding out who that was until Chris and I had this conversation. But I think you're right that the secrecy is a super important and I think troubling to some people element of this whole story. Like the notion that legislators will keep entirely secret from the public the notion that people have filed complaints against their own members. Isn't that convenient, right, that they're going to just do it all in secret, and then if there's no justification for the charge, then they just make it go away quietly.
Yeah, they worry about, you know, unjustified charges then becoming big news stories and so on. So that's the pushback, but I think as reporters we tend to be fans of transparency.
Absolutely. So.
Hey, Kevin McCollum, you know what I hate to do is to tell you we're about out of time here on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. I really appreciate you coming in. This is a fascinating story. I commend it to folks. It's on the 7 Days website in the paper. You can pick that up on almost any newsstand around these parts, and so check it out, folks. Hey, thank you very much, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Alrighty, we're going to take a brief break for some bottom of the hour CBS news, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with another first-timer on the Dave Graham Show, political scientist Linda Fowler.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and I'm going to be talking, I think, this half hour with Linda Fowler. She is a political scientist, professor of political science at Dartmouth College, and she is a commentator sometimes on congressional stuff as well as on presidential politics. An expert on the New Hampshire primary Linda Fowler, a longtime political science professor at Dartmouth College. She is going to be, I hope, our guest. We're having a little trouble reaching her right now, hence my stumbling around and hesitation there for a moment. But I'm hoping we will have her on with us shortly. We will be talking about yesterday's impeachment trial, first full day of the impeachment trial in Washington. Adam Schiff was getting a lot of kudos on some of the networks last night as being really quite an effective prosecutor of the Democrats' case against the Republicans against the president. And looks like we now do have Linda Fowler on the phone with us. Good morning, Professor Fowler.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining me. You're a first timer here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV in Waterbury, Vermont. I believe we are talking to you. You're over in the Hanover, New Hampshire area where you teach at Dartmouth College.
And that's correct.
Now, has a spring semester kicked in yet, or have classes resumed?
Dartmouth's on a quarter system. So they began the first week in January.
Oh, wow.
They're already they're already into their first midterm.
Okay. Some schools are on the semester
just
system
starting.
And they're just getting back this week. So but you're
I'm not teaching this this year. So it's one reason why I have time to talk about politics to people like you.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate it. So, I mean, there's so much going on. We could pretty much dive in anywhere. But I guess the big news today, obviously, is the happenings in Washington yesterday, where the House managers, and especially Adam Schiff, were taking the lead in their prosecution of President Trump in the Senate. My read of this, and tell me if you think this is right, this is the real high watermark. An awful lot of people seem to be kind of excited about Schiff's quote-unquote brilliant performance. You get that description a lot last night on a couple of the networks and so on. But I think people need to remember that this is, you know, it's sort of like your team's on offense if you're a Democrat. And there is still more to come, and it's going to be and the feel of it might change over the next couple of days.
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on. One, with the opening remarks, it was quite clear that the president's counsel, both Cipollone, and I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly, and Sekulow, were not expecting to spend a whole hour introducing their case, and they weren't prepared. And it was sort of embarrassing. And then there have been all these very arcane procedural maneuvers about how much time they're going to spend and when, if ever, they vote on calling witnesses and all sorts of amendments about the process. So I'm finding it very difficult to follow exactly what's going on. So I'm sure your listeners are with me on that one. But the other thing is, despite the level of preparation, I understand, since, of course, the public isn't allowed to see it, but there were lots of video clips of the president and his advisors making various kinds of statements, testimony from witnesses in the House. Mm-hmm. That really sort of drove home the point that the House prosecutors are trying to make. But it's also the case, the accounts I read in the paper this morning, that a lot of senators were not paying attention, particularly on the Republican side. They were going out to the coat room for breaks. They were, I think it was one of Rand Paul was doing a crossword puzzle. I mean, a number of them were making it plain that they didn't think the proceedings were very interesting.
Yeah.
So it's one, as you say, you know, it's one thing to say the home team, if you're a Democrat, is doing great, but it's another thing to know whether they're making a dent in the defense of the other side.
Well, you know, I mean, one aspect here also, though, is that clearly the House managers are putting on this performance as much for the public, maybe more for the public than they are for these senators who are kind of making a point of yawning.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem with impeachment. The framers didn't give us very much help. The impeachment is something that we borrowed from the British system. But of course, when we set up our Constitution, there'd never been a president. Nobody had any idea of what a president would do or be. The framers rejected the proposal of Alexander Hamilton to have a constitutional monarchy. And if you read the accounts of the debates in Philadelphia when they were drafting the Constitution, as I actually have done, there was a lot of worry about the presidency. And one of the drafters called it the fetus of monarchy. A big attack by the Anti-Federalists during the ratification process was that this office was going to take on the trappings of a court and would attract all sorts of hangers-on and people engaged in palace-like intrigues and mm-hmm. so forth. So there was concern about the presidency from the Constitution's critics, but also from among its proponents. And so you have Alexander Hamilton writing what's one of my favorite Federalist papers, comparing the presidency of the United States to the governor of New Hampshire, and concluding that the governor of New Hampshire had more powers than the president. So, in part because he had a standing militia that he could call upon, whereas there was no standing army in the United States. So a lot of the claims that people are making about the presidency really need to be evaluated in the context of when it was set up. And I think that's something that's missing from this debate, and particularly on the president's side, the claims that have been made about presidential powers are sweeping. We've never really heard anything quite like that. And even the Supreme Court on many different occasions has established limits. So it's, I guess there's no, the best defense is a good offense, and they have in my view, kind of a weak factual case. So it's better if they can distract people with procedural maneuvers and claim it's all, fraud. Mm-hmm. One thing that was disturbing to me was there were actual false claims made by the president's lawyers in their opening remarks. And in a regular court of law, the judge would have declared them out of order, and if they had persisted, would have held them in contempt. But this is not a court of law, and the rules are whatever the senators are willing to put up with. So it's, on the one hand, we have this idea, this is a real court, we need to have evidence, there needs to be a smoking gun, there needs to be a actual crime. On the other hand, this is a very political experience, and a lot of the usual norms of a courtroom don't hold here. And that's why everybody's playing to the public. So that's a long-winded way of getting to the audience for this. It's not the other senators. It's us.
It's the American people. And the American people, the project, I think, for the House Democrats is to get an awful lot of just citizens of the country to be calling their senators, including the Republican senators, and saying, hey, you need to pay attention. This is serious.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting that I saw a poll today that 72% of the public thinks that witnesses should be called.
Right.
And including more than half of Republicans.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. So public opinion actually is in favor of a more thorough trial than the kangaroo court we seem to have right now. But it doesn't seem to be mattering yet.
Well, and it doesn't matter in the context of, Mitch McConnell's Senate. But I wonder, how aggressive are the Democrats going to be, or would you recommend that they be, come fall election time when a third of the Senate is up, and including some allegedly vulnerable Republicans? It seems to me that if I were running against Cory Gardner in Colorado or Susan Collins in Maine or et cetera, I would be taking a lot of notes right now, and I would be building up a strong case that this incumbent that I'm running against didn't do his or her job.
Well, doing the job, that's the sort of rhetoric that actually does work against incumbents. They have all sorts of advantages in terms of name recognition, but basically when incumbents are vulnerable is when they've engaged in illegal behavior, they're not doing their job, they're looking out for themselves, not showing up for votes is a not doing your job offense that is often used against them. Mm-hmm. And this would be, I think, quite a persuasive one. Now, we're only talking about maybe four or five vulnerable Republicans. And there are a couple of vulnerable Democrats running. So there may be a calculation that if they win the White House by having a short trial and protecting the president, that they can afford to lose those seats and pick up one in one or two Democratic seats. So I don't, I'm not privy to these calculations. So, yes, the Democrats are making this argument to many Republicans. This could be used against you. And it is more than just a threat, an empty threat, because what we've seen is that more and more stuff about the president's involvement with this and an increasingly direct involvement is trickling out. And at some point, I think Republicans have to ask themselves, how much more is there? And can we really keep a lid on it for the duration of 2020? And more importantly, there's the wild card of President Trump. He, on the one hand, people who support him like the fact that he's a norm breaker and that he does his own thing. On the other hand, if he is acquitted and he views acquittal as exoneration, that's going to empower the people around him, who up until now have exercised some restraint over him, to basically, you know, let him do what he wants. And at some point that could produce the kind of backlash that would make a charge against a Republican senator quite salient.
Yeah. Now, one other aspect of this thing I find interesting is that since the December 18th vote in the House to bring these two articles of impeachment, there have been a couple of activities by the president that in and of themselves, well, I mean, there was the retweet of the identification of the whistleblower, which I'm told technically is a violation of federal law. In addition to that, there's quite an explicit expose in the Washington Post just in the last couple of days about the night of the inaugural back in 2017, January 2017, when the president was really pretty clearly violating the Emoluments Clause by having this inaugural event at his own hotel there in Washington and vastly overcharging for it and so on and so forth. And so here we have a you know, some more stuff, I guess,
not
is what you'd
forget
say.
Lev Parnas, the
right. I was going beyond the stuff that's even connected with Ukraine. I mean, the Ukraine case is the one that's being presented now. And I agree. There have been a lot of moving parts since then. I mean, John Bolton's willingness to testify, Lev Parnas coming out, et cetera. So the Ukraine case has been bolstered for sure. But I'm talking about other possible articles of impeachment. Do you see any possibility there, or are you worried at all if the House doesn't, say, pursue an Emoluments Clause article of impeachment, that that's going to be considered to be giving a pass to future presidents?
Well, I always wonder when one party is giving a pass to the president, as Democrats did for some things that Obama did in foreign affairs with respect to Libya, for example, that they don't see that what's good for the goose is going to be good for the gander.
Yeah.
And particularly the claims that the president's lawyers are making about being immune from oversight by Congress, which is a constitutional power, being immune from turning anything over, being immune from having anybody who's ever talked to him engage in testimony and so forth. These things, if they really are real and rather than just bluster, are pretty alarming, I would think, for anybody who is a Republican looking at the prospect of a future Democratic president. But hypocrisy seems to know no bounds these days.
Who knew that it would get this thick? I don't know. It's crazy.
You know, when you think about, you know, all the fuss about the Hillary's emails, and we have all of this other stuff going on with open, you know, unsecured telephone conversations with the president and all sorts of things like that. You just sort of go, okay, you know,
and by the way, I got to point out about Hillary's emails that the Justice Department just very quietly kind of folded that one up a couple months ago and said there's actually not anything prosecutable there. And that was the William Barr Justice Department, more closely tied to the president than really any Justice Department in memory, and a president who has loved that lock her up chant at his rallies. I really think it's a giant statement to say they actually couldn't come up with anything on Hillary Clinton, isn't it?
Right. Yes, well, because I think that was actually the third investigation.
Yeah.
And, of course, all the problems, all the investigations of Benghazi, and then, of course, there's been lying about whether soldiers were injured in the attack by Iran and the U.S. base in Iraq. And at first, there was nobody was harmed.
Nobody was hurt, yep.
And now we find that people are being hospitalized, and at first the number was 11, and now it's more. So it's at some point, ordinary people have to ask themselves, how much lying are they willing to tolerate? I see that shuddering at the idea that we might actually convict a president of high crimes and misdemeanors. We've never done that before in the history of our country. And it's as a political scientist and a longtime student of American politics, this is really momentous. And that's what's making me so angry about the way it's being handled in the Senate.
Yeah, I think you make a really, really good point there and even frankly in some of the media coverage, and I try to avoid this on my own show of sort of making light of any of it, because we shouldn't. This is very, very heavy duty stuff. And I think part of the making light of it, frankly, is just a desire to beat down the fear that it creates, frankly.
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, I think other presidents would have taken the opening of an impeachment inquiry and the eventual passage of impeachment as a sign that there needed to be a change in tone, if not a change in behavior in the administration. And since that didn't happen, I think people who favor impeachment are sort of saying, if this is what he does when he's under investigation, what's he going to do if he's exonerated? On the other hand, I think people who defend the president are also correct in saying, we've never done this before. It should be really, really serious. Mm-hmm. And what's troubling to me is I agree with that. And they don't seem to be really interested in finding out how serious it is.
A lot of people coming out in the last couple of weeks criticizing Bernie Sanders, and I'm wondering, do you think it's doing any damage to the junior senator from Vermont?
Well, it's always the case that the person who's the perceived front runner is the subject of greater scrutiny and also efforts to cut him back down to size.
Yep.
So this was completely predictable. I think Sanders has surprised everyone with the extraordinary level of his fundraising prowess. And it's alarming to people who don't want him to be the nominee that he will be able to stay in the race for as long as he wants if these fundraising numbers hold up. So I think that there's both political tactic and there's also sort of general surprise that he's doing as well as he's doing. At the same time, Bernie, he's not a Democrat.
Yeah.
And he's taking over a Democratic Party's nomination. And it's not surprising that people who've spent their lives being Democrats and building the party are troubled by the fact of that his outsider status is proving to be so popular among some people and so durable. So you have to have that context but it's also the case people get overtired. They've been campaigning a long time. Mm-hmm. It's easy for little things to sort of get blown up out of out of proportion. But it's also the case, remember, it's the same reporters over and over again. They're assigned to specific candidates. How many times are they going to cover Elizabeth Warren's campaign speech? They've heard it zillion times right now. Right. And the same with Bernie.
Yeah.
So if they hear a kind of on mic sotto voce conversation, that's going to prick up their ears and become news. And that's what happened with Warren and Sanders. And I think they both did a very good job of nipping it. You saw the picture of them arm in arm. Neither one of them wants a bruising battle within the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I don't think it works for either of them, and certainly not in the long term. I mean, and you're right. I think a moment of peak is about all it really was, and these things do get exaggerated. But I am wondering, any damage to Sanders from the fact that longtime Vermont Democrats Madeleine Kuhn and Peter Shumlin are among his critics?
Well, I'm not a Vermonter, so I need to be tactful here. but it is also the case that they may have a variety of concerns about Bernie.
Yeah.
None of them really shares his political agenda to quite the same
extent.
They're closer to the center of the party than Bernie is.
And Professor Linda Fowler, I hate to do this, but I've got to interrupt and close this out because we're about out of time on this segment of the Dave Graham Show here this morning. But I really appreciate you joining me on the phone from your hideout in New Hampshire over there. Let's do this again. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay. Take care, Dave.
Alrighty. Top of the hour news break with CBS News coming next. Let's go.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back, continuing into our second hour here on this January 23rd, Thursday show, 2020. And we have this thing going on in Washington called an impeachment trial, only the third time in American history that the House has forwarded articles of impeachment against a president to the United States Senate. And let's get updated here. Stephen Portnoy of CBS News joins me. Good morning, Stephen.
Hey, good morning to you.
And I wanted to check in with you. This is a lot of folks last night were, especially on the Democratic side, were calling Adam Schiff brilliant and talking about how this is a really brilliant, excellent example of the way a prosecution should work and so on and so forth. But I want to cool people down just a little bit and mention and tell me if I'm wrong about this. But this is really the high watermark, isn't it, of the Democratic case? We're still yet to hear from the president's defenders.
Oh, I think you're right about that. I think it will continue for the next 2 days as the Democrats, in an uninterrupted fashion, have all afternoon and evening to continue presenting their case. What you're hearing from Republicans who've spoken about this, and a few of them have, is that they're not being persuaded by Adam Schiff and that the argument that they're hearing is repetitive. And you have to wonder whether then that the Democrats intend to convince recalcitrant Republican senators to change their votes. If they're loyal to the president, then all of a sudden they're going to abandon their loyalty to the president and support removing him from office, or whether they're trying to make a broader play to the people watching and listening. And the idea is that perhaps they might be able to erode some of the president's support in the country, or at least bring over people who are in the middle, or firm up the opposition to the president in the country.
Do you think that some of the play here is actually for these individual senators' constituents to start calling the senators' offices and saying, you should quit taking breaks in the cloakroom and acting like you're falling asleep and pay attention?
Well, I think there's no question about that. I think that, what the Democrats are trying to do is captivate the nation's attention and say, we're using this instrument that the Constitution gave us to grab the public by the collar and say, hey, folks, listen up. This is existential, what we're talking about here. And if it doesn't get your attention, well, then, you know, heaven forbid and God help us. Because what you heard Adam Schiff say repeatedly yesterday is that if the president is able to get away with what they say he's done, then the not to say all hope is lost, but, you know, history will record that a president cannot be checked by either the law or lawmakers. And that, they say, is a terribly dangerous thing. Now, the question becomes, is what the president is accused of doing enough to, in the words of Republicans, overturn the results of an election? And Republicans are going to make the argument, as and certainly the president's lawyers will too, that whatever it is the president has been accused of doing doesn't rise to the level of impeachable offenses, doesn't constitute a high crime and misdemeanor. It's interesting. Jonathan Turley, who defended, who represented the argument against articles of impeachment in the House, right, before the Judiciary Committee, has an opinion piece this morning in which he actually goes after Alan Dershowitz's argument that he floated in a round of Sunday interviews last weekend. Dershowitz cited the acquittal of Andrew Johnson in 1868 when one of his attorneys before the Senate in the same room, it's really incredible when you think about it, back in 1868, argued that that Andrew Johnson didn't really commit a criminal offense and therefore shouldn't be impeached. Remember, I don't know how much everybody knows about this, but in 1868, in a chaos after the Civil War, while the Republican Congress passed a bunch of bills in addition to constitutional amendments that kept federal troops in the South for Reconstruction to ensure the civil rights of the newly freed slaves, Johnson wanted those troops out, and he wanted the war secretary out. Congress passed what was called the Tenure of Office Act that essentially would have made it a crime to remove the war secretary, who had been confirmed by the Senate. So Johnson removed the war secretary. He was brought up on charges and ultimately by a single vote acquitted. That is to say, one vote shy of the two-thirds needed to remove him from office. Mm-hmm. The majority of both houses certainly felt that he should have been, but not the two-thirds in the Senate needed to convict. Anyway, long story short, Jonathan Turley says, again, this is a legal expert who has been a consultant for CBS News, says that this is not a standard by which the Senate should judge this, because taken to its extreme, then the Senate could never convict the president for abuse of power. And that's the concern that Democrats are raising, that what has occurred here to them constitutes an abuse of power, and the Congress must stand up to it, or else no Congress ever will. They described the actions here as exactly what the founders had in mind when they gave Congress the power. Now, the other side of the argument, of course, is the idea that the president has his support in the country, and that a lot of people want him to remain president. They wanted him to be president when they voted for him, and they certainly wanted to stay. And that's why you have senators who are loyal to the president who are saying that they're simply not convinced that the president should be removed from office. Now, the Democrats are making the play politically to hope to change the minds of voters, so the voters change the minds of senators.
Yeah, I think, and I suspect that some of the Democrats are saying if we don't end up convicting and removing the president, we will have some pretty serious fodder for campaign debates come fall.
Well, I think, it's interesting. Americans these days, we tend to move so quickly to the next thing. Our press certainly moves quickly, and Americans' attention span is it changes rapidly. And the president benefits from that, and he knows it.
Yeah,
he often drives the conversation in different directions. The interesting aspect of this is the case that the Democrats are making in this way where they can captivate at least the Senate's attention, if not the nation's attention, dates back to last spring. And so what the arguments that they're making, that the Republicans who've spoken out about it deride as repetitive, go through the chronology slowly and carefully. The idea that starting in the spring of last year, there was a move afoot to remove the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. The allies of the president and his personal attorney, according to the Democrats, sought to do this because they feared she would be an impediment to their broader goal of putting pressure on the Ukraine government to announce an investigation into Joe Biden because it would explicitly and directly benefit the president's political prospects. And that's the corruption that Democrats are pointing to. Now, the president's lawyers will have equal time to make a case in the opposite direction. that the president was simply acting on his belief that government of Ukraine had been corrupt. He was convinced that the ambassador who worked for him and served at his pleasure, and the people around her and or in the Ukrainian government were out to get the president and or opposed to his election, and therefore it would be perfectly in keeping with his constitutional authority to seek a change. And by the way, the people who don't like it are disagreeing with him on a policy basis, and the Constitution says that only the president has the authority in the executive branch to make these decisions, and you know the rest of the story. So that you're going to hear a lot of those arguments starting on Saturday.
Beginning on Saturday, that timing is pretty funny because, I mean, not as many people following this stuff on the weekend, are there, or are there more? What do you think?
Well, no, I'm sure you're right. The idea is that, you know, people certainly have other things to do on Saturdays than sit at home and watch cable TV or C-SPAN, or listen to it on the radio. And look, that said, you know, perhaps the president's attorneys don't intend to spend 3 days going through these issues. And if they do, they'll also have Monday and Tuesday.
Right. So, all right. Well, Stephen Portnoy, thanks so much for some excellent analysis there. I really appreciate it. And you've been a home run hitter all week here. So it's great.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
All righty. Meredith Niles, a scholar at the University of Vermont. She was evaluating composting perceptions and behaviors of Vermonters ahead of the statewide ban on household food waste that takes effect this coming July the 1st. This is less than 6 months away, folks, so get ready. The research showed that while Vermonters support banning food waste from landfills and a whopping 72% already compost or feed food scraps to their pets or livestock, few say they are willing to pay for curbside composting pickup. The study offers important policy lessons for other states considering food waste bans as a strategy to combat the effects of climate change. Food waste rots and produces methane, a potent greenhouse gas. It's 24 times more powerful than carbon dioxide over a 100-year period. Composting has many environmental benefits other than just keeping food waste out of the landfill. It can aid in carbon sequestration and creates a natural fertilizer for farms and gardens. So composting, obviously a good idea. Should it be required in state law? We're going to be talking about some of those issues with Meredith Niles. She's a PhD assistant professor, UVM Food Systems Program and UVM Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences. And I want to welcome Meredith Niles to our program this morning. I believe she's on the phone. Is that true, Meredith?
Yes. Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for your... I think this is a return engagement for you, right?
It is. I talked to you last year about our really exciting work with Shelburne Vineyard integrating sheep into their vineyard.
Yeah, that was a fun segment. Got us off. I think that was the first of our... And by the way, I should mention, this is our weekly Thursday Seeds to Society segment, and that was the first of them. This is being put together with great cooperation, and I really appreciate it, from the University of Vermont's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. In our Seeds to Society segment, we've covered a wide range of different aspects of the way we handle food and agriculture and related issues here in Vermont and really internationally. There have been some internationally flavored programs as well. I want to bring in another guest here. Josh Kelly is a materials section chief of the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. That's part of the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources. He's an environmental analyst in the agency and as the materials section chief of the Department of Environmental Conservation, Josh Kelly is responsible for the implementation of Vermont's Universal Recycling Law, which really clamps down on us, as I said, this coming July 1st. Josh Kelly, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Dave. Thanks so much.
And I want to start, I guess, with Josh, since this is a change in state law we're looking at here, or at least the implementation of a change already made in state law. What do people out on the hillsides and streets and back roads of Vermont need to be thinking about and ready for come July 1st?
So on July 1st, food and food waste can no longer be put in the trash, which means we need to keep them separate and for various uses, like if it's food that's edible for people that could be used as food donation. Could be fed to animals, we were talking about just the intro to the show, or composted, or even sent to anaerobic digesters. So it is a change. It's similar to there's 10 existing landfill bans on various materials and products. Recyclables were added in 2015, or certain recyclables like your milk jug, your cardboard box, your paper mail. And this is the next phase of what was passed in 2012 unanimously by the legislature. There is some flexibility in the law, and I think we'll get to that later.
Okay. Just in terms of folks' sort of daily practices in the kitchen, one question I've had in our own household is we are meat eaters, and occasionally we come up with something like a pork chop bone or something like that. And we have a backyard compost bin, and I'm wondering, I've sort of heard over the years it's not a good idea to put things like bones in your compost bin because it causes all sorts of wildlife. So you get a green cone and treat those kinds of things separately. Am I on the right track so far?
You are. And just to be clear for listeners, if you have a pork chop, a bone, and you compost at home, you can throw that pork chop in the trash. You do not need to compost bones or meat if you compost at home. And that's actually written into the law that passed. So for Vermonters that compost at home, meat and bones can still be disposed of in the trash after July 1, 2020.
Oh, okay. Makes me feel much better because I had a recent incident where I took a pork chop bone and I threw it in the trash because it was, I had just weird reasons for not really wanting at that moment to go out to the green cone. And
totally.
I said,
"Uh-oh, perfectly fine.
I'm going to get busted for this and I feel terrible, but now you're telling me it's okay."
It's okay. Absolutely.
Okay. Makes me feel much better. Thank you so much. All right. And Meredith Niles, you actually, it looks like, did some polling. Is that right? Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, we did a research study through the Vermonter poll that is run through the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences through our Center for Rural Studies here. Mm-hmm. So on the 2018 Vermonter poll, we asked a number of questions to Vermonters about the food waste ban, which is known as the Universal Recycling Law. And we also asked Vermonters, you know, how are they managing their food waste currently? And once the law is implemented, what are they thinking they're going to do with their food waste then? And we were also really interested in understanding how they might use or pay for curbside compost pickup, which is an option that has been talked about a lot in the state, and definitely certain municipalities and communities are seeing more of that option.
Okay, so it seems like the response you got on the poll was, I don't mind participating in a better waste management practices, but leave my wallet in my pocket, please.
Well, I think there's a little more nuance to it than that, but you are alluding to some of the interesting results. Well, first of all, what we found was that the majority of Vermonters actually do support the food waste ban. We found that 55% of our respondents did support to some degree the food waste ban for landfills. And we also found, which was pretty surprising to me, a really high number of Vermonters, at least in part, composting in some way already. So when we asked them about what their current strategies were for food waste management in Vermont, composting or feeding their food scraps to pets or livestock was actually the most common strategy. We had about 72% of our respondents indicate they do that at least some of the time. Only about a third of Vermonters, though, said they did that all of the time. That was like the only way that they managed food waste. And then that was followed by people telling us they throw their food waste in the garbage, about 43% of Vermonters. And then using things like a garbage disposal or a curbside pickup program, those were less common. Mm-hmm. But I think that the results around composting are really interesting because it suggests that we have a high number of Vermonters who are at least already doing this in some way, and there's a great opportunity to engage those who are doing it in some way even further to do it completely with the July 1 ban. But also looking to the future, what Vermonters told us they would be likely to do in the future under this policy actually was to continue or increase their backyard composting or feeding their food scraps to pets or livestock. 76% told us they'd be likely to do that. And so that was really exciting as well because, again, it suggests that there's a lot of opportunity for Vermonters to get more involved in composting. Alluding to your question about the cost issue, we did find that curbside pickup programs for food waste. For example, there's one currently operating in Brattleboro that's been around for a long time. About 34%, only about a third of Vermonters said that they would be interested in using one of those, and only a minority said they'd even be willing to pay anything for it. So I think that could be one of the challenges, and we could talk about the implications of that a little bit more.
What is the, since you have an on-the-ground example in Brattleboro, have most Brattleboro homeowners signed up for the curbside compost down there, or is it, how's that penetrated there?
Yeah, great question. So my understanding from the solid waste district manager down there, a great guy named Bob Spencer, I'll give him a shout out, is that they do have a majority of their communities participating, but, you know, it's been a long process. Brattleboro's been trying to implement that policy for over a decade now, as far as I understand it, and Josh might have some insight into that program as well. So there are some great successful examples here in Vermont of where that's happening, but our study also alluded to the fact that we might find the greatest participation and the greatest willingness to pay for those programs in more urban, densely populated areas. And, you know, I think that makes sense for Vermont. You know, we're largely a rural state. We're one of the most rural states in the country. And in the article that we published, I talk a lot about the implications for rural states for trying to implement these kinds of policies. And that's where I think we're seeing that evidence with the high number of Vermonters telling us they're interested in composting, because that might be a better, more viable option for them in a rural region.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose backyard composting makes more sense if you have a little bit of land and live out in the hills somewhere versus if you are in an apartment on Main Street in Brattleboro. Curbside would make more sense.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, that there's been a lot of attention on how can we create a policy that has lots of options and lots of solutions in it, as Josh alluded to earlier. And so I think this suggests that there's different ways that Vermonters could comply with this policy that meets their needs.
We have a listener calling in. Let's go to Rich in Huntington. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. Obviously, you make the case that organic matter just should not be put in a landfill, whether it's yard waste or kitchen waste, because the inorganic, or I should say the anaerobic breakdown, produces methane, which is a very harmful greenhouse gas. But obviously, also, we're very short on landfill space in Vermont. So, you know, it's kind of long overdue, but the practical aspects here, it's like you said, it's very popular with people until they start realizing what the practical aspects involve. You know, we would make big demands on trash haulers. They already had to spend a lot of money modifying their trucks to take two different products now, recyclables and trash. And now we're saying that they're going to have, if they're going to pick up trash and recyclables, they're going to have to pick up basically rotting vegetables. You know, everyone thinks it's a good idea until we consider some of these practical aspects. Obviously, home composting is a great thing for people that are willing and able to do it, but there's going to be a lot of people who are not. It doesn't involve any expensive plastic bins. It basically involves a hole in the ground, or not even that. But the thing is, I know people that get trash haulers picking up their stuff every 2 weeks, and that's going to get real nasty in July when you've got 2 weeks' worth of rotting vegetables sitting in a bin somewhere. We also have a law on the books in Vermont that says you cannot create an attractive nuisance to animals. And if you get bears rooting through your kitchen waste, then you have to take measures to make it unavailable to bears. So right away, you've got a contradiction in law. I really wish I could come up with a good solution here, other than everybody backyard composts or uses a worm bucket in their kitchen or something. But it's a tough problem to have rotting food waste sitting around your house for a week in July.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Rich. I think you raised some interesting questions there. One I want to explore, and I might save this for after a little upcoming break we're going to have for a CBS News Minute and a couple words from our sponsors, because it might get a little involved. But I want to go to the proper way to compost, which I don't think is just a hole in the ground, from what I understand. I have heard that, and this question that Rich raises about attracting wildlife to your compost pile, you have to take care to avoid that and so on. We'll talk a little more in detail about the do's and don'ts of good composting practice after we go to a break for some CBS News. My guests are Meredith Niles. She's an assistant professor in the UVM Food Systems Program, UVM Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences. And also Josh Kelly, Material Section Chief of the Department of Environmental Conservation with the state of Vermont. The two of them will be my guests still with more time to come in the last half hour of the program here on The Dave Graham Show, WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay with us. We're going to go to some CBS News and a couple words, and we'll be back.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot, and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes, or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Well, we're talking about compost, and we have a caller on the line. I think he's been patient enough to wait through the break, and that's Bill from Moortown. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. How are we doing this morning?
Good. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Let me get my 2 cents worth in here. Number one, I'm a native, and on your coffee grounds, what I do, I save them. And I've got a place where it's not heated, and I keep it in the bucket there during the winter. And during the summer, you can put those on your tomato plants in the ground and work it in, and that helps immensely with the aphids. A lot of people don't realize that, and it's not in the book. Also, you take your compost, and I do have access to horse manure, and you can mix your whatever you got from matter right in with that compost and mix it up. And the heat in the wintertime from that horse manure will digest about 90% of that compost. And the animals will not come near it, especially the bear, because the horse manure kills the scent.
Wow. That's an interesting...
I was a trapper for years and years, and... Mm-hmm. We always took trap and covered around it with horse manure.
Yeah, well, you know, it sounds like a practical old-time Vermont solution to...
Well, I've been around 76 years next month.
Wow, okay.
All righty, good talking to you.
Bill, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate that. Let me bring in Josh Kelly here from the Department of Environmental Conservation. Josh, what do you think about that as a solution, horse manure?
It's excellent. It's absolutely excellent. And Bill's experience talks from what many composters know is that horse manure has an excellent balance of carbon to nitrogen and will compost by itself really effectively. But to both callers, and they raised really good concerns and really practical solutions in the case of Bill, I want to point out that in Vermont, there are over 100 transfer stations and drop-off locations where you can take food waste right now, year-round. And in some places like Huntington, and we've seen a lot of bear activity in the past several years, there may be times of the year where composting at home is really challenged. I've gotten a lot of those calls myself from residents who are had really good success in the late summer with composting, but then winter came and then spring came again, and the bear got to it. Adding carbon to your food scraps cannot be stated enough. It's so important to essentially break down that food waste quickly and with a hotter temperature that can render it basically into dirt, which bears don't go hunting around for just dirt.
Yeah.
But there are drop-off locations, and for many Vermonters, the Times Argus and Rutland Herald had a good article about this. They're using drop-offs, especially for their affordability. They're just really affordable. And when you separate your food waste into a bucket, it's not so bad to put it in the car as opposed to a leaky bag.
Well, yeah, there is that. Get one of those food grade plastic buckets with a nice tight lid, right?
Exactly.
And then you keep the smell down and keep it in a corner of your kitchen or even your porch and throw the stuff in there. And, you know, once a week, once every 2 weeks, so depending on the volume, how often you fill it up, take it over to the transfer station. Let me go back to that question, though, we were getting into a little bit before the break, and that is the sort of proper way or improper way to build a compost pile or a compost bin in your backyard. There are some ways that you really shouldn't go and other ways that are much better. Talk to us a little bit about that. Is that you or Meredith?
Well, I can start, and I'm sure Meredith can add. Yep. I think everybody, just like Bill, your caller, everybody has their own personal experiences.
Sure.
But the agency has put together, in partnership with solid waste districts at towns and alliances of towns throughout the state, the Dirt on Compost, which is a really good guide, and our Compost with Confidence guide, which is sort of the basic info sheet we provide. Many of the solid waste management entities, your town, your solid waste district, offer compost bins at cost. Those are usually the black plastic square bins. And we strongly recommend people also purchase what's called hardware cloth. You go to any hardware store, they'll know what you're talking about. It's galvanized wire mesh, and you put that on the bottom. You put that underneath the bin, and then you put the bin on top, because the bins are open at the bottom, which is very good because food waste is heavy with water, and you want that water to be able to nurture the soil and not build up. But that hardware cloth prevents, we've had squirrels dig underneath compost bins in the past. It prevents that type of activity.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, you want to add roughly 3 parts of brown materials like dried leaves, shredded newspaper is good too, with your 1 part of food waste. And an easy way to do that, the hardest time of year to do that is in the wintertime. And so what I recommend people do is to save several bags of leaves each fall to put into their compost bin over the winter, and especially to put it in around April Fool's Day or Easter is usually when we start to see our compost bins thaw. They do freeze in the winter. That's pretty natural for food waste to do that. But right around late March, you start to see some steam coming out of your pile, and that's when you want to make sure you're adding your leaves or your stored up shredded newspaper to really get that biological activity decomposing that food waste.
What about shredded up brown paper grocery bags?
They're perfect. Yep. It's basically carbon-rich material. It's made from wood fiber. Sometimes even going to like an Agway and buying wood shavings, you know, that are used in animal cages and things like that.
Yep.
Those are excellent carbon-rich sources that can really speed up your composting process. If you're unsure about should I be doing things differently, the general rule of thumb is probably add more carbon, and you should get some hotter piles with that.
And I only ask about the grocery bags because is that a reason maybe to ask for paper instead of plastic?
Well, it coming up also July 1 is the prohibition of stores giving out single-use plastic bags.
Oh,
and so they can give paper bags, but at a cost of 10 cents.
Okay.
So that's also a change coming up from the legislature passed the single-use products bill last year, and that comes into effect this July 1st as well.
That's really separate from this composting law, though, correct?
It is. Yeah. It is, yeah. It's not a landfill ban on plastic bags, but it's a prohibition on giving them out as they used to be given out.
Okay, I'm going to throw you a curveball now and ask you, Josh, or Meredith, whoever wants to take a swing at it to try. I just thought this was a kind of an interesting little tangent maybe, but years ago when I was a reporter for the Associated Press, I did a feature story in which I interviewed the then general manager of the Washington Electric Co-op. And we took a ride from the co-op headquarters in East Montpelier up Route 14 to Coventry, to the landfill where the co-op was just installing a new additional. They already had a couple, but a new, even more modern and powerful Caterpillar engine as a generator of electricity. And the engine was running on landfill methane. And and the general manager of the co-op was the electric co-op was telling me, you know, I'm an environmentalist and I want to follow all the environmental regulations and the best practices, et cetera. But boy, I love when food scraps come to the landfill because they make methane for me. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I totally understand that. And I guess I'd say first, having methane capture and engines that burn the methane is a good thing. It's a good thing for Vermont. It's a good thing for the households that get their power from those landfill to energy engines. But it's not the most efficient and effective way to capture methane from food waste. The most effective way would be through an anaerobic digester, like the cow power digesters that use manure from cows, and they capture all the, they're able to capture all the methane. Landfill methane is inefficient at capturing all that, so some is lost to the atmosphere, and that's what the impact that we're concerned about. We have looked at what the future projections are for those engines that WEC uses up at the landfill, and our estimates are that there's plenty of other methane-producing materials in the landfill, and the landfill is getting more materials now. As our Moortown landfill, as you recall, is not operational anymore,
right?
Such that they should be able to run those engines even after the food waste ban. And there's things like sewage sludge that comes in. There's wood, painted wood from construction demolition jobs. There's certain papers that aren't recyclable that are in the landfill. All those can produce methane as well. So we don't think there's going to be a huge drop in their ability to keep those engines running.
So those generators should be fed and happy for years to come, it sounds like.
In general, yeah. I think there's also, if you've watched how we've been with recycling over the past, it's really been three decades, we still have a ways to go with getting valuable recyclables out of the trash bins. And so it's not going to be like a July 1 food waste ban goes into effect and suddenly there's no more food waste going up, you know, in the trash. There's still work to be done there, and improvements to be made. But I don't foresee them having trouble with those engines anytime soon.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's kind of interesting to me that since we've been pushing hard on recycling, which is most of my adult life now, I would say in our household, I would say these days we probably produce, just in terms of the volume of waste coming out of our house and picked up by Casella every couple of weeks, you know, we have the blue bin for the recycling and the green bin for the trash. And frequently we get it picked up every 2 weeks. And frequently when we put out the trash bin, it's like maybe a quarter full. And the recycling bin is always brimming. So we're probably 4-to-1.
Yeah, that's pretty common.
Trash easily.
When you're an avid recycler and you take food waste out and compost it, you really are shocked by how little trash you have. And that's been our experience when we've talked to many people who've made that switch. Some people then can use a drop off. It just saves them money over time, and just it's shocking how little trash they actually produce.
Yeah, we mentioned Brattleboro as a place where we've done curbside recycling, and I know curbside compost pickup. In fact, I think you said, right?
Yep.
And I wonder, Meredith, maybe you can tell me this: other cities around the country that have gone to curbside compost pickup, and how's that working out?
Yeah, great question. So I think from a policy standpoint, there's a couple of points to make here. First of all, there are other states that have levels of a food waste ban similar to Vermont's. Vermont's is the only one that goes all the way down to the actual household level. But for example, in California, some of our New England neighbors, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, all have some type of threshold, basically, through which if you're generating so much food waste per week, you have to actually keep it out of the landfill as well. So right now in those states, it's mostly hitting more commercial and industrial types of practices. And so Vermont is sort of the ahead of the game and sort of front on the household level issue. But we do know that there are other municipalities around the country who have brought this down to the household level. They're mostly large cities. So Seattle, for example, and San Francisco are two really good examples. And I think there are definitely different challenges with implementation between doing something in, you know, San Francisco versus Vermont. They don't exactly equate to the same type of place. So I think that's partly what the agency is working through right now, and also what our research has been able to provide some insight on, which is, you know, the multiple ways that Vermonters might be able to divert their food waste. But there's also some pay services that are springing up. So rather than sort of a regulatory policy, there are some paid services, including some that exist in Burlington, I know, where you can actually pay to have someone come and pick up your compost and your food waste each week. So there's sort of a number of different policies that are happening, but generally speaking, where they're mandatory are in these much larger cities. And so I think what we're doing here in Vermont and what our research has spoken to is what might this look like in more rural areas. And that's where I think we might have this suite of potential options that households and commercial retailers can use to try to divert their food waste out of the landfill.
Yeah, because, I mean, we alluded to this a few minutes ago, but it strikes me that the state regulations would have to account for the fact that it's really a much different experience if you are, you know, you have 40 acres and you live out in the woods or on a farm or something, than if you live in a you know, tightly packed suburban or urban neighborhood, even in Vermont here. Is that right?
That's right. And I'll let Josh speak to this a little bit further as well, but there actually has been some changes to implementation of the law, specifically related to what haulers have to offer. And your first caller from Huntington was sort of alluding to the idea that, you know, there's already been a lot of additional cost for haulers to implement some of these policies. And so there has been a change as of last year with regards to what's required for hauling. And so now haulers are required to offer food scrap collection to non-residential customers as well as apartment buildings with four or more units. But there has been some changes, I think, that sort of recognize why that requirement for haulers might be a unique challenge for such a rural state. And I'll let Josh comment on that as well.
Josh?
Yeah, Dave and Meredith, thank you. I think I'm just going to step back for just a second, because I think when we look at our waste, it's important to recognize that food waste is nearly 20% of what's in our waste. So of the material we landfill every year, food waste accounts for about 20% or almost 80,000 tons of waste each year. And some of that is perfectly edible food. Since the law on food waste has started to go into effect, food donation, the food bank, the Vermont Food Bank reports a near tripling of food donations since the law began. A lot of that is from grocery stores and supermarkets. And since it's so significant, you're seeing states and local governments focusing on food waste, and not just on composting it at homes per se, but also on reducing and preventing food waste. I mean, when you see perfectly edible food in a trash dumpster, it's sad. It's sad that we as a culture waste that much. And so I want to mention that, because I think it's as much of this law is about relooking at our waste in a different way. I think in general, Vermonters are not wasteful with food. We love our macaroni and cheese. You know, we're used to taking it for lunch the next day as leftovers.
Yep.
But it's the most important step we can take is to not waste food in the first place. Eating what we buy, planning our meals, and then separating the scraps, the inevitable coffee grounds, onion peels, and eggshells that we're not going to be eating. And it's not a requirement of the law that people compost at home. But we want to make sure people have options. And so from the beginning, we've promoted people considering hiring a curbside hauler, people using a drop-off, a transfer station. And as I mentioned, there's over 100 of those offering food scrap collection currently. And we've also supported home composting. We put out some grant money to local solid waste districts who offered discounted home composting bins with training, getting at that idea of how to add carbon properly and leaves at the right times of year. And what we've seen so far since the law began with hauling is that there's been a near doubling of the number of haulers that offer food scrap collection. Currently, it's over 20 food scrap haulers, and the state has commercial services for food waste. So from restaurants, that's nearly statewide. Nearly every part of the state has a service provider for the commercial scale. For residential, it's growing, and there's been some leaders in that. Going back to Brattleboro for just a minute, Brattleboro has the town contracting for a hauler to provide trash recycling and food scrap collection pickup curbside. And so since the town contracts for that service, the people are all paying for it, but it's for the compost and recycling, it's through their property taxes.
Got it.
So that's different than in Waterbury going out and asking a curbside service, going out and subscribing to a $12 per month service that comes to your door. Many of the services that are residential are in that, you know, $10 to $20 a month range for food scrap pickup. But if you're in a denser area, it may be cheaper if there's more people that join. Part of this is about trade-offs. If you have less people signing up, then you have less people to spread the costs over. So if people decide to compost at home, and they can easily save themselves money, but then it's more costly for other folks. So in Brattleboro, it was particularly successful because sort of the whole community was already getting served with these three services.
What about meat and bones? Was that just considered too difficult? Are they still going to be a problem going into the landfills, or how do we account for that?
I think there was a consideration that if Vermonters are composting at home, there's not a requirement that they have to put that in their compost bins, sort of to the concerns you alluded to at the beginning of the show. But if you're a restaurant or if you go to a food scrap drop-off site, all those locations, or you use curbside hauling for food scraps, they take all food waste. Industrial-sized composters where this material is going are able to take meat and bones and effectively compost that. Sort of along the lines of the listener, Bill, who said that horse manure produces hot compost mix. Even in the winter, their large piles can melt a foot of snow because of the hot composting process.
Yeah.
So it's not a problem.
Okay. And some people actually, I mean, I've heard of cases where people can use a compost pile. I've heard the term Jean Payne mound, where you can actually run like a hot water line or a water line through the compost pile, heat it up, and maybe take care of some of your household hot water needs. Is that right?
It is. And actually at Moodoo, the Vermont Natural Ag Products in Middlebury, they're doing just that, using their compost piles to recover heat that is now used to dry some of their compost product. They previously were using propane, and it's helping to offset some of their propane purchases significantly. Also can heat their building. So because they have scale and they have installed a heat exchanger system, they're able to capture that heat and that renewable energy.
Just a minute or so to go. One question I had about the one question I had about the businesses that are popping up to collect compost. Are we down to? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I am a lot out of time. Hey, I want to thank my guests. We came up to the end of the show here rather suddenly, but. Josh Kelly from the Department of Environmental Conservation, Meredith Niles of the University of Vermont's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Thank you both so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks so much, Dave.
And that's going to about do it for today's Seeds to Society segment and for the Dave Graham Show here on this Thursday morning, the 23rd of January. Thanks for joining us, folks, and we'll be back broadcasting live tomorrow from the State House in Montpelier. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio.